Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every weekend where we visit with World War II veterans. We want to honor them for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, I think we're educated quite a bit, often even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And here in California, there are a lot of places we can go to learn about that World War II history. You've heard me talk in the past about Castle Air Museum in Atwater. We've gone down to the Estrella Warbirds Museum in Paso Robles and done some shows there. And this week, we come to you from the Minterfield Air Museum in Shafter, California. Our guest spends a lot of time here now, and he spent some time here during World War II as well. So we're going to get that story from 88-year-old Don Westfall of Bakersfield, California, but originally from O'Keene, Oklahoma. What kind of hometown was that for you growing up?
That was a very small town, about 1,000 people. Mostly farm people around. It was a big farming area.
Growing up, do you have a big family, small family? What was life like for you in that farming community?
I had two brothers, of course, and my dad and mom. That was my family.
Now you look back, and World War II defines a lot of what happened to you. But before the war, I'm sure you had ambitions, things that you thought, hey, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. What were your ambitions as a young man?
Well, I tended to go toward aircraft of some kind, to do something in aircraft, flying, mechanic, whatever. But I love to fly. I love the aircraft industry.
What was it that hooked you? Did you read about Lindbergh? Or did you see something flying over? Or what was it that gave you the bug?
Well, I'll tell you. Those were the days of barnstormers. And we had one come into that little town, and he landed in a pasture west of town. And, of course, everybody went out to see the airplane. And he was taking up rides, and my dad let my brother and I go up for 50 cents apiece. And that pretty well hooked me.
How old were you?
Couldn't have been more than 12 years old if I was that old.
And now you're 88 and you're still hooked on flying, huh?
Well, I'm not flying, but I've never lost the love of it.
Well, one question I like to ask every veteran, because every veteran seems to have a memory of this, whether he was in the service yet or not. And in your case, you weren't in the service yet. December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day and how you found out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
Well, we had gone to church that morning quite early and went home. We had lunch, and I always went to town and stopped at a service station and talked to a guy. So when I walked in, he said, "Do you know that Pearl Harbor was bombed?" So this was sometime afternoon before I found out. I knew about it.
What did that do to you to get that news, to figure that out?
Well, I knew good and well I was going to be in the service somewhere along the line. And the guys that I was talking to was also in line to go to the service. So that's what I was only 17. So my draft age didn't come up for another almost 8 months.
So did you wait to get drafted, or did you try to take matters into your own hands?
At one point in the last part of 1942, yes. I was going to an aircraft engine mechanic school in Stillwater, Oklahoma, and a friend of mine and I did this. We decided to go home, and we were going to go enlist in the Air Force. Well, on our way home, we found out they had closed enlistments. So what happened? We turned around and went back to school. Later on, I found out about how to get into Air Cadets. And this was the early part of 1943. So I went to Oklahoma City and took the written test, and I was accepted on that. A requirement for us to get into cadets, we had to volunteer for induction. So I volunteered and was inducted in May of 1943.
And everybody that I've talked to that ended up in the Army Air Corps wanted to get in to be a pilot. Some of them ended up navigators, bombardiers, gunners, whatever, but they all wanted to be pilots. Obviously, you wanted to be a pilot, but did you have this ambition or idea in your mind? That's the plane I want to fly. I want to do this and that. Did you have any of those thoughts?
No, all I want to do is fly. The type of airplane didn't make any difference to me. I ended up in the B-25, which I'm very happy about, but I would have flown anything they put me in. That's the way I felt about it.
Was that a challenging process? Because it's not just, hey, I want to fly a plane, and they put you in the cockpit. There's a lot that you have to go through. Did you find any of that difficult, or did you ever think, you know what, maybe I'm not cut out for this?
I never found it difficult because I had a goal, And they couldn't get too rough for me because my goal was out there getting my wings and my commission to fly airplanes. So what else happened? I went along with discipline, yes. In pre-flight, we were very much disciplined. But as time went on, the discipline became less and less because they were wanting pilots.
And you moved here to the San Joaquin Valley after the war. You've been in Bakersfield since 1946, but it was the military that first brought you here to Central California. When was that that you ended up right here where you're sitting right now at Minter Field?
February of 1944. I was here from February to April 1944.
What was your impression of this area, this base? What was it like at the time? Because here you guys have preserved some of the buildings. You've preserved a lot of artifacts from Minter Field, but you're someone who can actually remember back and tell us what it was like.
Well, the cadets were, I was mainly interested in cadets because I didn't have time to do anything else. Most barracks was just open area. Our barracks was partitioned off in rooms of four. Like I explained to you, my barracks was way down beyond here, and I'll show you later some flights, the flight line ready rooms that we had to march to, and this is where we received our flight instruction. There were ground school rooms, but I don't remember where they were. Our mess hall, we couldn't ask for better food. In fact, I had an officer who was here tell me that he at times got up from the officer's club and went to cadet mess hall because they found they got better food. But the weather was good. I don't think we missed a day of flight. I don't remember that we had any rain or any fog during that time.
What kind of aircraft were you training in at the time?
I was training in the BT-13 Vulti Vibrator, Vulti Valiant, actually.
Yeah, the Vibrator was not the official name. That's just what you guys called it. And why was that?
That was called a vibrator because under certain conditions, the airplane would vibrate violently. Normally, it wouldn't, but under certain conditions, it would.
I'm sure you experienced that a time or two. What did it feel like?
Well, you wanted to jump out.
If people come to the Minter Field Air Museum now, it's open every Friday and Saturday from 10 to 2, they can see a BT-13, right?
Yes, sir. We have one in our hangar. This airplane was here in World War II.
And you're here every week giving tours and telling some of your stories to visitors of the museum. When you walk by that airplane and look at the way it's painted and the way the instruments are and everything about it, what kind of memories does it bring back to you?
Very good memories. I mean, we did a lot of things. We had, this was our first taste of formation flying, our first taste of instrument flying. I don't remember whether we flew at night. Possibly we did, but I don't remember whether they did or not. But it just has a very comfortable feeling to sit in there and fly that.
Well, I'm pretty sure I know one thing you did at night while you were here, and I know you have great memories of the BT-13, but there's another reason you remember Minter Field in a very special way. It was here that you met your wife way back then?
Yes, sir. It was a situation where the junior women's club of Bakersfield would bring out ladies and have a dance. And they had a board dance. They set up a board in the middle of the dance floor. Ladies come in on one side, the men on the other side. When you met out the end of that board, that was your partner for the night. Uh-huh. That's the way I met my wife.
Well, that's pretty spectacular. I don't know too many people who can tell that story. So was it just chance or dumb luck or what?
Just chance. I mean, and after that, we started talking. And it come to find out her parents came from Oklahoma in a little town about 20 miles from where I lived.
Well, it's a good thing you weren't the next guy in line, huh?
Well, I guess so. Yeah.
And did you have an inkling that night that there was something that was going to happen between you two?
No, it's just conversation is all we had that evening. Uh-huh. After that, the cadets were restricted to the base first 5 weeks we were here. And so when I did get permission to go out, I called her and we had a date and went from there.
And she knew and you knew that you weren't going to be here very long.
That's right. Yeah, she worked in the hospital here on the base. She worked for a doctor.
So when you left here and moved on to your next assignment, did you think you were ever going to see her again?
Oh, yeah, I felt like it, yes. In fact, we communicated quite frequently.
A lot of letters back and forth?
Yeah, I still got them.
Those are some treasures. That's great. When was it that you got your first experience in B-25?
After I graduated, I was assigned to Randolph Field to become an instructor in the UC-78. Well, when we got back to Pecos, they didn't need instructors, but they wanted five pilots to go to Columbia, South Carolina to be co-pilots on bombardment crews. My pilot had already, he took his advanced training in B-25, so he was already a B-25 pilot. And I was introduced into the B-25 in about September 1944.
What was your first impression of that plane? Because I would imagine that it's a little bit different than the old Volte Vibrator.
Oh, yes, definitely. You got a whole raft of instruments and switches, and you got your throttle, and all that stuff was down here in the middle. And you got trim tabs all over the place. You had to learn, I'll tell you.
It sounds like it might have been just a little bit intimidating for you to try to swallow all of that.
I don't recall I was intimidated. I wanted to learn, but I didn't feel I couldn't learn. If the other guy did, I know I could.
That's the spirit. Was that a fun plane to fly?
Definitely. In fact, overseas, I flew the plane occasionally by myself just for take guys over to for R&R or something like that. I flew the B-25 a couple of times without anybody else in the airplane.
That's when you can really have fun, I suppose. And I guess another question I should ask about that, not necessarily the same model of the B-25, but by that point, we're 2.5 years removed from Doolittle's raid on Tokyo, and I imagine that the B-25 had a bit of notoriety or fame around it. Was that something that had occurred to you?
Well, you got to look at the mission they took off on the off the aircraft carrier. And I mean, that made the B-25. There wasn't any other airplane in the Air Force that could do that. But that was notoriety. And then you see some of the history, and some of the enemy didn't like the B-25 at all.
Yeah, that's an interesting note, that aircraft, because of taking off the Hornet and bombing Japan, you were kind of a target if you were flying a B-25? Is that what you're saying?
In the work I was doing overseas, we were not a target, no. Because we were never close to any combat of any kind.
Well, and we'll get to what exactly you did, but when you were training in the B-25s, did you know that you were going to be part of weather reconnaissance, or did you think you're going to be on bombing missions?
We had ever thought that we were going to be on bombing missions. And we were actually in the staging area to go overseas in a bombardment crew. And they wanted five crews in Oklahoma City for weather reconnaissance training. It just so happened my crew was one of them.
And I see the look in your eye when you say that. And I have a feeling there's a little more depth behind that comment, that you've probably thought about that moment a few times and wondered what would have happened to you if you went to a bomb group.
Yeah, that was toward the end of the war, actually, a lot of bombing. I don't think the 25 got that much problem.
From that point on, yeah. A lot of them had been in North Africa and Italy before that.
Well, they were flying mainly with low level. I don't think they lost too many of them that way.
Well, it's nearly 70 years now since the end of the war, and the B-25 is actually one of the planes that has survived the best. There were nearly 10,000 B-25s produced. If you add up all the different variations, the different models of B-25s, there are actually quite a few that are still flight-worthy, and many more on display, like the one up at Castle Air Museum in Atwater. Minter Field doesn't currently have a B-25 on display, but it does have a docent who flew one, and he's the gentleman we're hearing from today. You can catch Don every Saturday at the museum from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., Minter Field Air Museum is just west of Highway 99 in the city of Shafter, just north of Bakersfield. And we'll get back to his story and find out, if he wasn't bombing the enemy in that B-25, what exactly was he doing? Hometown Heroes is going to be right back after this. They say a picture is worth 1,000 words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need 1,000 words, just 2 of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, 2 more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you 2 more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period.
He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
Have you ever been on a submarine? And hanging out with Nemo at Disneyland doesn't count. How about a World War II submarine preserved just as it was in 1945? Well, here's your opportunity, thanks to the Wahoo Base Submarine Veterans. On Saturday, July 13th, you can tour the World War II sub USS Pampanito, part of the San Francisco Maritime Museum. I'm planning to be on the bus, but more importantly, we'll have veterans on the bus who actually served on subs just like the Pampanito. It's a chance to experience history in a very unique way, and you'll also have 5 hours on your own in San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf area. The bus will leave Fresno at 7 a.m. on July 13th, 0700 for you veterans. We'll roll back into Fresno at approximately 9 p.m. or 2100. $69 covers the bus, a tip for the driver, and your admission to the USS Pampanito, that World War II submarine. Ready to reserve your seat? Call Ted Dick at 559-834-2191. That's 559-834-2191. You can't see a World War II sub every day, so let's go explore some history together July 13th.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, the program that each weekend reminds you that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes in your hometown. They may not call themselves that, but we can call them that because we know they put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. We have men and women today making that same selfless choice. But the ones we hear from on Hometown Heroes are primarily from what Tom Brokaw famously called our greatest generation. There were more than 16 million Americans in uniform during World War II, and each veteran's story we've learned over the years is unique. We've heard so many perspectives over the years on this show, and we're getting a new one today from Don Westfall. He's originally from O'Keene, Oklahoma, a small farming community northwest of Oklahoma City. About 1,200 people live there now. Don has spent the last 67 years in Bakersfield, California, and he spends every Saturday at Minterfield Air Museum, where he's been a docent now for over a decade. Minterfield looks a little different now than it did when he was stationed there during World War II, but there are some key parts of it that have been preserved, and we're going to hear more about the museum a little later in the show. For now, back to where we were in the chronology of Don's World War II experience. You told us that you were about to go overseas with a bombardment group, but they needed 5 crews to train for weather reconnaissance, and your crew was one of those 5. And you say weather reconnaissance, and some people say a B-25, weather reconnaissance. How does that work? What were you guys doing? What was that training like? Was this an eye-opener for you?
I would say so, because we would fly. In fact, on one mission, we flew through a cold front between Oklahoma City and New Orleans. And then we flew to Memphis, and we had to stop for fuel, and we flew back to the same cold front going back to Oklahoma City. Because we, I mean, if you're going to fly weather, you better fly the weather as it is. And, of course, we were on instruments most of the time.
And, you know, I think people think about pilots during the war, and they think about the flak, and they think about fighters that were trying to shoot them down. A lot of people don't think about the weather, but that could be just as big an adversary, huh?
Well, a lot of our missions, we flew 4 hours instruments and 4 hours visual, because our mission started at our base in Gushkara and flew south as far as the Andaman Islands.
Well, let's talk about that, heading over there. And that this is another part of the war that I think gets forgotten. The whole China-Burma-India theater often is overlooked because people think about the Pacific and they think about Europe. When was it that you found out you were headed for India, and what do you think your reaction to that was?
Well, we didn't find out where we were going until we were an hour offshore going to Puerto Rico on our way. In fact, we flew a B-25 from Savannah, Georgia to Calcutta, India.
Wow. That's a lot of little hops and jumps along the way, huh?
Yeah, quite a few. But they gave us orders, and we didn't know where we were going until we were an hour out on the over the Atlantic Ocean. That's when we found out we were going to India.
And what were your thoughts about that? Did you have any idea what to expect?
None of that, not whatsoever. I mean, we were just going to Kashgar, India, and we were going to do what they told us to do.
And was that an uneventful journey on the way there, or did you hit some hiccups along the way?
Well, we had a little mishap on our way to Puerto Rico, the first leg. But one of our engines cut out on us, but it came right back on. But from there on, no, we had no problems that I know of.
One of the engines on your plane or someone else's plane?
On our plane.
And how many engines does a B-25 have?
Two.
Exactly. So you got two engines and you have problems with one of them. That's a big part of your power there. Did that make you nervous at all?
Well, we were pretty well loaded. Normally you can fly on one engine with a B-25.
So you weren't too concerned about it?
Well, initially, yeah, we were concerned. Things began to happen pretty quick. But we leveled out and everything was fine.
And do you remember what it felt like for you to be heading overseas, because you've done all this training? You've got a special young lady you'd like to see again sometime that you're trading letters with. Were you anxious? Were you nervous? Were you scared? How sure were you that you were going to come back someday?
Well, of course, I wasn't sure I was going to come back. But I didn't feel any anxiety or fear or anything like that.
Why not?
I don't know. I mean, millions of guys have gone overseas. Millions of them come home. So I felt it was just part of the military life, as part of the war. And I was going to Calcutta or going to India.
Here at the Minter Field Air Museum, you've got a nice little display when you walk in the front door that shows some pictures from your time in the service. It shows you and a B-25 crew in front of one B-25 called Wizability. I guess my question, and I think the question a lot of folks listening would have, is, what special equipment did you have on your B-25 to equip it for weather reconnaissance compared to what a B-25 bomber would have had?
Well, we had radar, and then our nose was full of weather instruments. That's where the weatherman stayed, and it was full of weather instruments. We flew our missions at 1,000 feet. Every hour, we go down to 100 feet so the weatherman could take all the various weather conditions down at 100 feet. And that was done four times before we got to Andaman Islands. And then we got to Andaman Islands, we did what they call a sounding. And what they did, I don't know. We ended up at about 8,000 feet. So we'd level off ever about three or four times, and the weatherman would take in different readings.
And maybe you can explain too for the folks at home why this was so important, because you know, there were 16 million Americans in uniform, but there are a lot more people here back home that were doing things, and everybody was doing something that had a role. And it seems to me that your role as the pilot, and on a broader scale, the role of your plane in weather reconnaissance had an impact on a lot more people than just those five or six guys on the plane. How do you see that role looking back and the contribution that you guys as a crew made?
Okay, we had a big effort taking material in China by Air Transport Command. Now, that's what our job was. Now, the weather started way down in the Bay of Bengal. It came up the Bay of Bengal and turned and went over the Himalaya Mountains into China. And so it was our job, and we flew a mission every day, is to chart that weather and send it to 10th Weather Headquarters in Calcutta. They in turn distributed it to the various air transport command bases. So it was to tell the pilots, et cetera, and the air transport command what kind of weather they were going to run into.
And if the information you guys collected and transmitted back to headquarters was faulty, what were the potential consequences for that?
Well, I just finished reading a book, Flying the Hump, and they didn't pay any attention to the weather.
They went no matter what?
Yeah, they flew in the weather no matter what. And so I would suppose, that rather reconnaissance squadron wasn't over there the entire war. I would say they were probably over there in 1943, early 43 or something like that. That's when they went over there. A lot of these early pilots, the first pilots that were there, actually flew Hurricanes in the Caribbean Sea off the coast of Florida.
They'd been through some of those trials by fire, as it were. Well, and this is dangerous work, though. I mean, you talk about flying the hump, and I've had some veterans tell me about the things they witnessed in flying that route. And I think at some point it was called the aluminum highway, because they would look down and they'd see all the wreckage of all the planes that had crashed there. What about your perspective? Did you ever feel like you were doing dangerous work?
Not until I read a book on flying the weather, yeah, where there was flying the weather all over the world. I thought we had a pretty soft job. Yep. And when I started reading that, we didn't have such a good soft job. I mean, what? Our last trip out of China from Chengdu to Calcutta to our base in India, we took off in the soup, and we climbed the 15,000 feet in the soup. And we flew in the soup until we got to India, which was about 4 hours or 4 hours and a half. I mean, we were 15,000 feet, and we couldn't see up, down, or sideways.
What does that feel like? Because to me, having never experienced that, I think I'd be really nervous and really scared. But for you, I mean, did you have enough experience that you trusted those instruments? Were you trusting in something else? How did you deal with what for a lot of us would be a real unnerving situation?
Well, my pilot and I had both done this before. We had flown on instruments. We were both instrument trained. We knew all the emergency procedures. And I thank my pilot for giving me the instruction that he gave me, the things that I didn't know about the plane. And no, I did not feel anxiety or anything. He flew it for a while. When he got tired, I'd fly it for a while. And there was nothing like this.
So you flew every single day?
No. Somebody did. We got a mission about every fourth day.
Okay, I was going to say that was going to present quite the difference than most crews. So have you calculated how many missions you flew?
Our missions were counted in hours. I had about between 200 and 250 hours of mission time checking weather.
What are the moments that stand out for you now when you look back as the moments that were out of the ordinary, that maybe you felt like this isn't your average mission, this is a little dangerous, or this is a little nerve-wracking? Or maybe even something that stands out that was lighthearted or comical. I'm sure not every mission was the same.
No, a lot of them were in clear weather. But like I said, some of the missions we flew 4 hours instruments and 4 hours contact. And I don't recall that we'd ever had any problems anywhere along the line. Actually, my pilot, when we started flying missions, he says, "I'll take off and you land." And then the next mission, now vice versa. So on these long trips between Gushkar and Andaman Islands, we change seats every 2 hours. So you can fly in 2 hours. But we knew the mission, we knew the airplane, and we trusted the airplane. I don't recall any time I was really scared.
I imagine Kashgari, India, was a lot different than O'Keene, Oklahoma. So on those days that you weren't flying, what kind of adventures and eye-openers did you experience?
None. We stayed on the base. Gushkara was a little village just outside of the, probably not as big as O'Keen. But it was just a small village, but I never went into the town of Gushkara. The only time I went to any place is when we would take guys down to Calcutta for R&R, and we'd usually go into Calcutta, and there was a big restaurant called Furpo's. We always went there to have a water buffalo steak dinner.
How is water buffalo, by the way? I've never tried it.
I didn't see it a whole lot different than anything else I'd eaten.
Sure tasted good back then, it sounds like. As this went on and you spent hour after hour in the air on this weather reconnaissance, did you have a sense that the end of the war was getting near?
Well, you know, V-Day in Europe took place.
V-E-Day in May of 45?
Yeah. That happened right after we left the States. We were on our way overseas, I think, when we found that out. And, of course, it didn't take long after that for Japan to...
So you were there in India when Japan surrendered?
Yes.
How did you find out about that, and was that a big deal to you guys?
Well, we just found out, I suppose, by communication from Calcutta headquarters or someplace, or over the radio or something, we found out about it. I don't know.
What did that mean to you, that the war was over? Where did that take your thought life?
Well, frankly, the day that they surrendered, my crew and another crew was destined for Nanning, China, to fly the typhoons off of China coast. Uh-huh. Well, when this news come forward, we didn't go. We never did go. We did fly missions until about September, October, somewhere in there, before they disbanded the weather squadron.
Now, you say fly typhoons, and I imagine a lot of different people get a different image in their head. If you're going to investigate that kind of weather, how close do you actually get to that weather formation, or a typhoon, a hurricane, as it may be?
Well, you know, when they were flying typhoons, they would fly inside of them, and that's how close they got.
You fly right into the eye of the storm?
Yes.
But you never had to do that? And the Japanese surrender spared you from doing it that day.
Yes.
All right. I guess that was pretty good timing, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
And speaking of timing, we've hit that time again for another break. When we come back, we're going to find out what Don dealt with in coming home from World War II, how he ended up in California, and we're also going to find out why he spends so much time these days at Minter Field Air Museum. He'll give us a few highlights of what you might find if you visit the museum as well. Admission is free, by the way. Hometown Heroes is going to be right back after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. I'll give you some local phone numbers in a moment, but first, a little more about Honor Flight from World War II veteran and longtime U.S. Senator Bob Dole.
Hello, I'm Bob Dole, speaking for the Honor Flight Network and asking for your help. America owes a debt of gratitude to the 16.5 million World War II veterans who, without doubt, helped save the world. Today, the ranks of our most senior heroes are dwindling. More than 1,200 of these heroes die each day. Those in their 80s and 90s lack the means to safely visit the National World War II Memorial, which honors their service and sacrifice. Every week, the Honor Flight Network flies veterans free of charge to Washington to see firsthand the National World War II Memorial erected in their honor. These veterans are flown to Washington from all parts of the country. Your generosity will help continue the Honor Flight program for these greatest generation veterans. And I urge you with all my heart to give whatever you can.
Yes, Honor Flight is absolutely a great cause to support, and if you're a World War II veteran, it can be the experience of a lifetime. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-303-3837. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming to you this weekend from the Minter Field Air Museum in Shafter, California. 70 years ago, Minter Field was the largest training base of its kind on the West Coast. It was named for Hugh C. Minter. He was a veteran of World War I who died in a mid-air collision in 1932. If you were at Minter Field during World War II, you'd find more than 65 buildings as part of a giant operation. The museum is housed in the original firehouse for Minter Army Airfield, and you'll even find the old fire truck from way back in 1945 still in the garage. During the war, you'd see cadets training in BT-13s or UC-78s, what they would have affectionately referred to at the time as Volte vibrators or bamboo bombers. Eventually, the base had B-25s and P-38s, and it always had cadets. More than 11,000 graduated from training at Minter during World War II. One of those cadets has been kind enough to spend the hour with us today. He volunteers every weekend to share a little history with visitors who take advantage of the free admission at the museum. Don Westfall might show you a Norden bomb site or a Link trainer, and he can explain to you their significance. That's the big part. The museum is open every Friday and every Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Don's here every Saturday, so come on by. I have some photos of Don and the museum posted on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, so you can check that out, too. We've heard about how Don met his wife here at Minter and about the unique missions he flew in B-25s, not bombing missions. He was investigating weather conditions with the 2nd Weather Reconnaissance Squadron at Gushkara Airfield in northeast India. I said that wrong earlier. That's Gushkara with a G. That's where Don was when World War II came to an end, and he stayed there on into 1946. When you found out you were coming back home, what was that experience like for you?
Well, I didn't find out I was coming back home till about, I was in India until I think we got on the boat the 1st of February. So we were scuttled around India three or four places before they finally put us on a ship to come home.
That should have given you plenty of time to find some souvenirs, huh?
Yeah, I've got a few at home.
What are the ones that are meaningful to you?
Well, I bought my wife a little hand deal. It was made of silver and gold. I bought it in Calcutta.
A bracelet?
No, it's a pocketbook. I had a couple of rings I bought in China. With, a couple of daggers I bought in China. When I went through Natal, Brazil, I bought a pair of little boots for my oncoming son. I don't think he ever wore them. I got a Mandarin hat I bought in China.
Well, I think I missed a chapter along the way. I was assuming you didn't get married till you got back. It sounds like you got married before you went over, huh?
I got married before I graduated from pilot school.
And you knew you had a son on the way?
Oh, yeah.
I just want to make sure I have it straight. You're overseas flying. You've never met your son.
In fact, when he was born, the Red Cross sent a telegram to Gushkara. Uh-huh. Now, I was sent to China to become the co-pilot on that crew. Because the little guy was the pilot, he was due to go home. Now, they got the telegram, they sent it to Chengdu, China. In the meantime, we came back to India. So it was 2 weeks after he was born before I knew he was even alive.
And I'm sure you knew that he was supposed to be born around then, and you're wondering, hey, when's that baby coming?
He came about the same time as he was supposed to, you know, the last of May.
What was that like, to sit there half a world away and know that you're a father?
Well, rather exciting. Yeah, got a few cigars to give out, this type of thing, yeah.
And I guess it gave you a little extra incentive to make it home, huh?
Yeah. Of course, you know, in our missions, we didn't have any combat or anything like that. The only thing that would keep us from coming home was if the aircraft itself would have give up on us.
Which is always a possibility every time you go up. Well, I've got to ask you then, too. When you made it back to the States, I know you're excited to see your wife, and I'm sure that was a great reunion, but to see this little boy who you've never seen a picture of to that point?
No.
What was that moment like for you to look into those little eyes and realize this is my son?
Pretty exciting, yeah. Yeah, he was about 10 months old when I first saw him.
Did that give you some pride to come home knowing that victory was achieved? At a great price, sure, but that you had been a part of something that changed the world?
Sure it did. Absolutely. I served the country with pride, and I did what those people told me to do, and I didn't ask for anything. I gave what was necessary, what they were requiring.
And so obviously Minter Field has a special place in your heart. This is where you met your wife. Then after the war, you ended up making a career out here in Bakersfield in the oil industry. What was it that made you decide, you know what, I'm going to go volunteer at the Minter Field Air Museum and tell everybody about this history?
Well, that's very strange. I was working for Lumberjack. I don't know whether it's the old Lumberjack. After I retired in 88 or 87, I got antsy, so I got a part-time job at Lumberjack. So I was waiting on this gentleman one day, and we were talking, and he had a oil company T-shirt on, and we were talking about it, and I don't know how it came about, but he said something about Minter Field Air Museum. Well, I says, I was a cadet out there, you know, and he perked up, and he says, why don't you come out and see us? Well, I did, and that was all it took. And I've been out here ever since. I only come out on Saturday because of my health. I can't get around that much anymore.
So you've been doing that for what, 12, 13 years now?
Yes.
How long are you going to keep it up?
As long as I can. See that walker over there?
Yep.
I use that once in a while.
Well, you've been giving us the tour without it today, so you must be feeling that adrenaline working pretty well.
If we go with the hangar, I'll use it.
What do you get out of it when you're out here and you're explaining to a fellow World War II veteran or a 12-year-old kid what all this memorabilia here at the Air Museum means? What do you get out of that?
The fact that, especially with the young people, I'm teaching them history. This, everything you see in here is part of history. The people who come in who was in the military and all that type of thing, I enjoy. But the one thing I really, really enjoy is the number of people I meet. I have met people from all over the world. I have friends in Australia I still email and send Christmas cards. I met a couple from Sao Paulo, Brazil. I met a guy from Wales who was at that B-24 that crashed in the Sahara Desert. And I've had people from Japan, China, Canada, Mexico. It's just, I get as much joy talking to those people, seeing those people. In fact, there's an airplane out here. It's an Italian Aeromoce, and you'll see that as we go over. A guy walked in here with another couple, and lo and behold, he was from Italy, and lo and behold, that guy had flown those back in the 70s. This is this type of thing you run in all the time.
You guys have certain artifacts from the base as it was in World War II preserved around here. What are the items that you get the biggest kick out of that you guys have on display here?
Oh, I don't know. It's just a conglomerate of everything that was used in World War II. I don't especially have any certain thing that I enjoy other than just I'm part of it. The display of me in that case, I like to tell people that's a sample of what over 11,000 cadets went through during the war. You could take their face and put them in place of my face, wouldn't make any difference.
Yeah.
It'd just be a different name.
And I don't want to get too melodramatic here, but it seems to me that your life would have been a whole lot different had you never spent that short time here at Minter Field.
Very much so, yes. I would have never met my wife, probably. It's just the thing, that's the way it happened.
How do you explain that, the way everything worked out, that you were here just long enough to meet your wife, and you go overseas, you come back, you get to meet your son for the first time, and still be back here all these years later? It's quite the story. How do you make sense of that? Do you have an explanation for why things worked out the way they did?
No, not particularly. I came here, met my wife, we got married, we had a child. The fact that I was sent to instructor school, I still don't know how that happened. There was 20 of us out of 450 cadets that was sent to instructor school. I don't know, you just went through it because of the sign of the times. I will say this, this country will never be as cooperative as it was during that period. Never will we ever see it.
You mean how united everybody was behind the cause?
Yes. The work they did, the savings that they You know, they put aluminum pans out on the curb so they pick them up. Kids that keep the lid in the off the chewing gum deals and all that type of thing.
Yeah.
You know, people would set up donut shops and radio stations. So if a group of soldiers come through, they'd have coffee and donuts while they were there or something like that.
Yeah.
We never had a car pass us on 99 when we were going to town. Never.
They'd always stop and pick you up.
That's right.
You know, one more thing about the museum I should ask you about, and I know that you've had a lot of conversations with a lot of people, and hopefully some people will hear this interview and come out and want to shake your hand and thank you for your service too. But in this day and age, every key part of the war, the survivors of those events are dwindling and they're getting fewer and fewer. And I've interviewed a lot of Pearl Harbor survivors over the years, and they have their stories and they're dying off just like everybody else. But you guys have a Pearl Harbor survivor here at the museum that's never going to die off because it's not a living, breathing thing. It's a big hunk of metal that was there on December 7th. Tell us about that and what kind of reactions you get to that when people take an eye at it.
You're talking about the tug. Yeah, you know, they'll be standing around looking at everything and they see that and they always take pictures of it.
And tell us what it is and what it was used for.
It was a tug that you used to pull airplanes around. That's what that was primarily was used for.
And in these parts, with all the agriculture, someone might take a look and say, oh, that's a little tractor over there, but this has a little bit of history behind it.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, it spent the time in Wheeler Field during the war. Yeah.
So there's another reason to come visit the Minter Field Air Museum. You can see a Pearl Harbor survivor, not the kind you've heard on Hometown Heroes before, not the living, breathing kind, but a hunk of iron in the form of a tug. It survived December 7th on Oahu, and now it is in pristine condition in Kern County. What else would you like our listeners to know about Minter Field Air Museum and why they might want to take a trip out here to Shafter?
Well, I feel like we have a very diverse museum. We have a lot of different artifacts in here. It goes clear back to World War I, and you got to realize that those World War I artifacts are nearly 100 years old.
You mentioned World War I and history, and there's a photo over there that has a little bit to do with you. Your dad and your uncle were both in World War I?
Yes, they were both in World War I. My dad was not in very long because he was too young to be in it for the whole period, but my uncle spent time with the American Expeditionary Forces in Europe.
And I sense there's a little family pride there.
You bet there is. Yes, sir, I show that to everybody.
Well, I don't blame you. That's a great legacy for you and for your family. And Minter Field Air Museum here is a special glimpse back in time. Don, I know that you don't think your story from the war is all that exciting, but I think for the rest of us, I'll speak for myself for sure, it's inspiring to see you out here at 88 with your walker and your enthusiasm for keeping this history alive at the museum.
We keep it clean. We try to build our displays. We do have a gift shop, and we do have some displays in the trailer outside there, and it's history, and that's why I'd like for especially the younger generation to come out. And we have tours of school kids, that type of thing. Maybe 40, 50 kids come out here, and we take them through.
Well, I just want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. Thank you for what you continue to do here at Minter Field Air Museum to keep history alive. Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you think we ought to know?
No, I think we pretty well covered it.
Fair enough. That is Don Westfall. Find him every Saturday at Minter Field Air Museum just outside of Bakersfield. That's a great thing to do in the summertime with the kids out of school. If you have kids or grandkids that like to learn about history, take them to the museum. Wherever you're listening to the program today, you're close to a great museum with awesome volunteers to put those displays in perspective for you. You've got the Estrella Warbirds Museum in Paso Robles. You can spend hours at Castle Air Museum in Atwater. And if you live in the Fresno area and you've never been to the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor, boy, are you missing out. You'll learn something, I promise you. That's it for Hometown Heroes today. One thing I've learned from so many veterans over all these years is the thought I leave you with each week: freedom is not free.